Okay, we'll get started. Every week we have teaching from the Bible here. And the moment as a church, we're going through a series of messages from the book of Proverbs, which is in the Old Testament. This series is called This Life. And this is a book filled with practical wisdom, how to live life skillfully. It's written mostly by a king called Solomon. He was the third king of Israel and famous for his wisdom. This week we're looking at the subject of parents, relationship with parents and how to be a parent. It's a huge subject in the Bible, and it's a very big subject in the book of Proverbs specifically. In fact, you could say that the whole of the book of Proverbs is about parenting because it's written as a book from the heart of a father to his son. And you could certainly relate it as a father or a mother to a son or a daughter. It doesn't need to be only locked into a son-father relationship. It's the pleadings and the advice and the counsel coming from a wise parent to their offspring. And it's written from another world, if you like. It's from a time, a culture, a place that is different than the one that you and I are used to here. It's from a different world. And so the voice that Solomon speaks with can sound a little bit alien. And it can even jar us. It can sound quite disquieting, the way he speaks to parents and the way he speaks to children of parents. It can surprise us. It can seem otherworldly. But I want to urge you to be humble rather than dismissive. I want to urge you to not commit the fallacy of chronological snobbery, thinking that because this was written thousands of years ago, that means that it's regressive, that it's somehow primitive. Actually, what we find as we look in the life of Solomon is extraordinary wisdom, especially on the subject of parenting. Parenting is a big subject. I know that not everyone in this room by any means is a parent. Not everyone watching this is a parent. Many of you will be parents in the future. Many of you yearn to be parents, and maybe you've not had that opportunity. All of you have had parents in one way or another. Some of you still have relationships with your parents. Some of you have sad relationships with your parents, broken relationships with your parents. So this is a subject that is close to the heart of every one of us in some way. I don't believe there's a single person that needs to assume that this message won't connect with them. I think rather we should be asking that, God, if you're there, you would perhaps speak to me through this. So let's listen to a few verses on parenting from Solomon from the video that we'll just roll.
For the Lord reproves him who he loves, as a father the son in whom he delights. Grandchildren are the crown of the aged, and the glory of the children is their fathers. A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish man despises his mother. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. Just listen to your father who gave you life. And do not despise your mother when she's old.
So start by saying that the children of humans have a different life experience than the children of animals in many obvious ways. One of them is that they stay with their parents for longer. Generally speaking, this is one of the things that makes the human race different from all other biological life. Children or offspring of animals will be biologically able to reproduce quickly, and they don't have a long period of nurture with their parents, generally speaking. Humans are different in that respect. It's normal for children to stay with parents and not even to be equipped for reproduction until 12, 13, 14 years into biological life. In all of history, that's been generally assumed as a kind of a hint that the way people and cultures have adapted to that is by assuming that parents especially have a vital part to play in training, rearing, equipping, and preparing their offspring for life. That period of time under the care before full adulthood is vital. It's preparation during which parents have a responsibility to pass on to their children an entrustment of wisdom There's something that they have received, perhaps from their parents, from their tribe, from their culture. And in most cultures of the world, it's believed from above. There's wisdom that comes through parents, but it isn't initially from parents. It comes from further back and further back and further back. And there's a kind of a deposit of wisdom that the gods or some eternal spirit has allowed people to receive so that they can do life well. And that wise children are the ones who listen to the wisdom of their parents. I'm pointing out that these ideas that Solomon seems to hold about the responsibility of parents to pass on wisdom to their kids are not unique to the Bible. They're assumed in most human cultures. It seems to me that the human culture that you and me are a part of in this city of Brighton and in cultures like ours in the Western scene are unique in that they've, for the first time in history, kind of resisted this idea. We've really questioned in the last few generations this assumption of people like Solomon and all others really in history gone by. We've questioned the idea that children need to receive some particular deposit of wisdom from their parents. We've especially questioned the idea that parents possess a kind of an innate sense, a given, a just assumed sense of authority and responsibility to pass something on. We've questioned that in a big way, certainly since the 1960s, but even before that. You could say it goes back to the time of people like Rousseau, the French philosopher, who came along preaching this new idea, really, that children are basically good. And the best thing for children is that they should be left alone. Because what they really are in themselves is innately good and rational and wise and happy and joyful. The thing that corrupts them is actually society and the interference of their elders. If we just left children to blossom in their own time and space, they would flourish. And that kind of teaching has found its way into our culture in all kinds of ways. It's certainly affected education, but it's also affected the way we think about parenting. Actually, the role of the parent in our society is increasingly kind of questioned. It's even, to be fair, on a social level, kind of marginalized. Parents are expected to have less and less influence over their children. In some societies in the last 100 years, it's been actually state power that's tried to replace the position of parents. So you go to places in the communist bloc maybe 50 years ago, or certainly back to Nazi Germany or to some of the fascist countries, the role of parents was diminished deliberately by the state. The state power saw it as their responsibility to take the place of parents, to nurture the young instead, seeing families, households, as a bit of a threat. We don't want these parents raising the children. These are our children. This is our country. This is our nation, our state. We should control them. And that certainly doesn't seem to follow in this country particularly. It might in some places like North Korea today. But in a way, who needs all the fuss and the hassle of the state flexing its muscles to control families and children? Well, actually, the job has mostly been done in our generation by just sheer consumerism and mass media and global economics. The reality is that you don't need, George Orwell's Big Brother. You just need Channel 5's Big Brother to shape society and to shape the next generation. It happens in a softer way, but it still happens. Because we live in a time where certainly in the Western world and increasingly all over the world, people who reach the age of, they don't even have to reach their teens. They can be a lot younger before they're exposed to sort of ideas, information, technology, opinions, attitudes, fashions, things that you ought to have, things that you must desire, things that make you cool or things that make you not cool. They're being influenced by these things. We're being influenced by these things at a younger and younger age, not by having to even go to buy a newspaper or watch a movie at the cinema, it's just by what we've got in our pockets. The power of social media, the power of media in general to shape the attitudes of the young and to take the place of authority amongst the young is unprecedented. It's incredible, and it's global. It's not just in Western countries. It's not just in cities like Brighton and Amsterdam and Berlin. It's in cities like Lusaka and Nairobi and Delhi and Shanghai. In fact, increasingly, someone who turns up to start a degree in one of those cities or start a new job in one of those cities has got more in common with a 20-something in Brighton than they have with their parents. Because the cultures and the kind of family or even tribal identities that have been nurtured over centuries or even thousands of years by traditional cultures have gradually, in some cases, and then more suddenly, in other cases, been replaced by just mass communications, mass consumerism. Buy this, watch this, listen to this, be like this, and you'll be accepted. These are the things, these are the opinions, these are the attitudes that will prevail in city after city after city after city after city, and you get a culture that's gradually taken away from the influence of parents. Now, I'm just commenting. That just seems to be an obvious trend. I think that Solomon would be concerned. I think Solomon would have something to say, because I think that Solomon would say to parents, you have a calling. You have a responsibility to pass something on. There's wisdom. There's an entrustment. There's a responsibility that you have towards your children that's unique and distinct, and you mustn't abdicate that. And neither will we just kind of assume that the truth of the idea that children and young people just should be left to themselves, because as long as they're left to themselves, they will learn the freedom of self-expression. The thing we must never do with children, the thing we must never do as parents or even teachers is, you know, the ugliest, horrible word in the world, indoctrinate them. We mustn't teach them. We mustn't put things upon them, put wisdom that we have upon them. We mustn't do that. We must just let them express themselves. We must just let them find their self-expression. But here's the thing. There's a big question we should ask about that. Is it not true that to really express yourself freely, it's necessary in the first place to submit to a disciplined process of learning in order to freely express yourself? It's no good saying to a 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old, well, we're not going to teach you anything. We just want you to express yourself. We don't really want to give you our values, our ideas, our wisdom. We just want you to find your own. Because what they will potentially do is find nothing at all, but nevertheless be very confident about what they have. An obvious example would be language itself. If you want to express yourself, you need to learn how to. You need to learn how to speak, how to write, how to communicate. That's a process of submission. It's learning. It's coming under submission. And the people who are most expressive, the great, I don't know, writers or poets, whoever, people who know how to communicate through words or even through music, are the ones that have gone through a submissive process to learning a discipline. Great concert pianists will look like the freest person that's ever been. When you see them play, when you see the way they do their sonatas or their concertos, the way they kind of they pound away at the keys, they play their scales and they go up and down, it just looks so free. But you've got to understand, one of the reasons they're free is because they submitted to a code, to a discipline. They spent hours practicing scales when no one was listening and they were probably quite bored, but they did do that. They submitted nevertheless. In the end, they become freer as a result. This is actually part of the way God seems to design things, and we are a bit foolish to resist it and think that we're going to get freer by never submitting. Solomon is clear about this all the way through this book. My son, receive discipline, receive wisdom. Come under discipline. Do not despise discipline. It will free you. It will promote you. If you receive wisdom, if you search for wisdom, if you make it your goal, if you pursue it with all your heart, it will promote you or raise you up. But we seem to be a little suspicious about that. And I think we barely know yet the result of that. as a culture, people who've been around for longer than me will probably be able to say things have changed. The way that people treat each other, the way that crime happens, the way that people treat money, the way that people treat society has changed. The way that young people think, the values they've grown up with, really different to 50 years ago, really different. And I'm quoting people who are older than me, but that's the kind of prevailing thing you hear, isn't it? Often. But I'm wondering if we've even started to see the impact of these kinds of changes truly. We tend to think, well, society's doing okay, especially if you're middle class and you live in a nice city like Brighton. It's not quite so nice in some other parts of this country. Certainly not that nice in some parts of Brighton, actually. But, you know, if you live in a suburban place and your kids go to a fairly nice school, then you don't really feel the effect of the social change that happens when the family gets melted down. But I tell you, it will come, and it gradually comes more and more. Society doesn't change overnight anyway. It changes gradually. There's a delay effect. It's like the temperature adjuster and the shower. You have that experience where it's just not quite the temperature you want, and so you turn it up. And about 10 seconds later, it's still not the temperature you want, so you turn it right up. And then you realize, oh no, there's a delay effect, and your skin has fallen off. Because you forgot that it doesn't take 10 seconds on your shower. It takes 30 seconds. There's a delay effect. It takes a while for your adjustment to have its real changing effect. It takes a while for ideas about parenting and family to have their real effect. And here's the thing, here's the saddest thing. The people that affect the first are the poorest. The people that make the decisions and have the brilliant intellectual ideas, the Russos and the 60s people, and people that come up with these lovely flowery ideas of how children are lovely and they should all go to nice schools where they don't have to obey the rules, they don't have to wear a uniform, they don't have to do anything. They just get free and they just get to wave flowers all the time and never learn anything. And parents, we don't need parents, man, we just need to be free. Those people who make those ideas generally live nice, affluent lives in the suburbs. The people who suffer as a result of those cultural changes are the people who live in the poorer states. Families get devastated because those ideas run amok, and society is poorer as a result. It's already happening. People will tell you, yeah, our lives are worse because families aren't strong, because parenting is done badly, because parents don't lead. But their voice doesn't get heard that often, probably because they're not as fashionable as the rich middle class people. So this is a big issue. Solomon wants to rub our faces and say, look, parents, you have a role to lead, to nurture, to pass something on. Don't shirk it. Don't be cowardly about it. It's quite a strong message. You get to places like chapter 2, verse 6. The Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. The Lord gives wisdom. This isn't just parental advice. It's not just, well, you can take my advice, or you take the advice of whichever TV show, whoever, you know, anyone's advice out there is all the same. We've all got the same. No. Solomon says, no, there's a kind of wisdom that comes through parents as a gift from God. As a gift from God. It's God's gift. Parental wisdom is a gift from the living God, and it should be therefore received and honored as such. And it means that parents need to learn to operate with a sense of conviction and courage. Parenting isn't easy, especially if, well, some kind of parenting might be easy. Parenting, when you read the book of Proverbs, you go, this is a challenge. Someone wrote a book a few years ago called Parenting Isn't for Cowards. That's a good title for a book. I never read the book. I don't know if it's a good book, but it's a good title. That's true. It's not for cowards. It takes courage. It takes conviction to believe I've got a calling. If I'm a father or a mother, I am set here to lead in the home. There's a responsibility I have. It won't always make me popular. I need to sometimes say the thing that my child doesn't want to hear. I need to have a plan, a sense of direction, a vision, a purpose, a sense of destiny for them, which I can pass on to them. I want to stand by that calling and operate out of it with wisdom and courage. It's not an easy thing to do. It's especially not easy given the unlevel playing field we play on. So later on in the same, in Book of Proverbs chapter 22, verse 15, Solomon thunders out, folly is bound up in the heart of a child. It's a direct contradiction of Rousseau, direct contradiction of much that prevails in our culture. The Bible has always said, the Bible says from start to finish, that we're not born good. And here's the thing. Now, we've tended to, as I say, we just culturally, we have assumed the opposite for so long. But increasingly, even some of the top social scientists are really banging on this question, saying, why have we assumed for so long that children are born good? Why have we done that? People like Steven Pinker, who's written some very famous books, a Harvard psychologist, who wrote a book a few years ago called The Blank Slate. And he points out that genetics and cognitive neuroscience and all kinds of areas of scientific discovery and investigation are calling massively into question the Western post-Enlightenment assumption that children are basically good, that people are basically good. He's saying, no, that just doesn't measure. If you look at these things scientifically, you've got to question that. There's a real problem in the heart of humanity. And people like Pinker and other scientists are asking these kinds of questions and pointing at the facts. And in a way, we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, the Bible's been saying this all along, but anyone who's opened their eyes and refused to believe that the emperor's wearing amazing clothes will agree. Any parent would agree. I've got 5 children. I might as well be wearing a lab coat. I know what I'm talking about. Right? I've seen this up close. I have 5 children, and they are precious. They are wonderful. I'm not being sarcastic yet. They are delightful. I love them. They're wonderful. There's so much about them that I love. But they're evil. They are. I am. Steven Pinker says they are. I'm quoting scientists as well, just to help you to understand. It's not. I'm not just kind of coming back. The Bible says this. Let's be honest. Let's open our eyes. I mean, I just know from watching the way they behave. Preachers always say this, and it's true. You never have to train a child to disobey. You never have to train a child to be selfish. You never have to train a child to be rude to his brother or sister, to hit his sister with a shovel. You never have to do that. One of my sons, William, is the youngest. He's the cutest thing on planet Earth. There is no question about it. Scientifically, I could prove that to you. It's definite. I tell you, he's got this problem still. I watch him when I say to him, don't go there. He was walking there. When I said, don't go there, he ran there. Literally true. Don't go. Come back, come back. That's when he runs. Okay, this is an issue then. Even in the cutest one, the one who's the cutest, he's still as the cutest. I see it in his eyes. I see the way he says, no, at times. One of my kids, the first word was more. My mum says that was my first word, so you know, it's in the genes. It's if you spend time long enough, you'll see the cuteness. You'll see this lovely image of God. God made kids. He likes kids. But friends, there's something very fallen about kids. And we are just being stupid if we pretend otherwise. We're just being blind. Solomon says, cut it out. Wake up. See the issue. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child. So the calling is on parents to be courageous, to lead, to say, well, this is my responsibility. I want to help. I want to train. I want to see how I can serve this child completely out of a heart of genuine love and care. This is important. We need to get this, and I'll spend a few minutes on it to help make the point. Solomon says in chapter 4, verses 3 and 5, let me read to you. When I was a son with my father, tender, the only one in the sight of my mother, he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words. Keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom, get insight. Do not forget and do not turn away from the words of my mouth. When I was tender, the only one in the eyes of my mother. Do you hear the sense of affection? Do you hear the tenderness? This is the Bible ideal of motherhood and fatherhood is full of tenderness. Full of love, full of affection and compassion, sympathy, sharing life together. It's not disciplinarian. It's not authoritarian, although it uses discipline and it uses authority. It's not a stranger to discipline and authority, but it doesn't stay there. It does these things out of a full heart of love, reflecting the heart of an eternal Father who is full of tenderness, full of compassion. That's what he's like. You read this book, you see that description of him everywhere. This is God being shown through parents who love their children passionately. But here's the thing that we miss. Because they love them, they discipline them. Because they love them, they lead them. Because they cherish them, they decide for them often. They train them. They see their role as awesomely important. They sense the responsibility, the sacredness of it. I am a parent. I'm a mother, a father. I have an entrustment of wisdom to pass on. Something was passed down to me. Maybe through my parents, certainly through some means. There's wisdom. I must train them in. I must find it myself so I can do a better job of training them in it. This is my calling to do this as much as it is to do anything else, to train and raise children with wisdom. If you're not a parent, if you think one day you might be, I want to hopefully inspire and encourage you through the words of Solomon to aim high. See what you could do in raising children to know and be wise before God. This is actually a battle, though. Like I say, you may feel great compassion, but to train a child who has a heart bound up with folly means you need to be strong. You need to use authority. And we tend to fall off the horse on either side here. We're not good at remaining in the sweet spot. And some people temperamentally will be good with authority and discipline, very comfortable with that, but very incapable of genuinely showing love and tenderness. And some cultures will be like that. Some cultures have really got it nailed when it comes to authoritarian father figures. You go to some parts of the world today, even in spite of what I said earlier, there will be places in the world that are still full of the kind of disciplinarian culture when it comes to raising children. But those people will sometimes be the first to say, we don't know much about showing affection and grace to children. And then there'll be the opposite. There'll be cultures pretty much like ours, where we're pretty high on what we call grace, which often is just indulgence, which is just no rules, antinomian. We don't really care what you do. We just don't care at all. We just want to have an easy, convenient life. So you go off. You do what you want. You get your advice and your wisdom and your opinions from anywhere you want. That can sound like grace, but it isn't. But yeah, generally, we will have more books, even Christian books, talking about how to be loving to your kids in a whatever way that's defined, than there would be on how to train, how to bring discipline. Solomon's keen on both. You read places like chapter 13, 24, whoever spares the rod hates his son. But the Lord, he who loves is diligent to discipline. Now, that's a verse that preachers will often wriggle out of. It's not the only one. There's quite a few places in Proverbs where Solomon says that kind of thing, and it's a little uncomfortable. People like me are going to spend a lot of the time when they preach saying, well, it doesn't mean rod when it says rod. It means, I don't know, we'll make up something. You know, it means marshmallow stick. Because I always just think of some way to kind of, you know, sweeten it, to make it easier on and it's a difficult subject to talk about for sure in our culture, especially when it's such a hot thing, when people assume that we're talking about maybe something even abusive. Trust me, this book is going to talk about abuse. I mean, in a couple of weeks, we'll talk about Proverbs on anger. And Proverbs hasn't got anything good to say about selfish anger. So we'll get to that. The Bible is never going to encourage parents to be harsh with their children, to be abusive to their children. The Bible will be very strong against. Jesus said that one of the most scary things he ever said was about people who are abusive to children. So don't fear that the Bible is leading us down a bad path here. It's leading us down a sane, wise path and saying parents need to remember their authority and lead in the home and use discipline. Yeah, sure, we could be creative about what that means. We may have some ideas about how that really works in each individual child's case. So I advise that. Learn children. Understand them. Understand what makes them tick. Understand, but make sure they understand where the boundaries are. They understand what is wrong. And they taste the wrongness of it, sometimes even physically if necessary. They understand, that's bad for me. I mustn't do that. This is dangerous. Why would I go there? Later on, chapter 29, verse 15. A child left to himself brings shame to his mother. That's a glaring and obvious observation. A child left to himself. And that's the issue that Solomon is concerned about. Children are not meant to be left to themselves. They're not. They're too special. They're too loved by God. They need training. They need the care and compassion that is expressed with authority sometimes, but out of love. Which side of the horse would you fall over on? Which side of the horse? Maybe culturally we would fall down more on the kind of let's just be affectionate and tender side and forget the discipline side. But what about you personally? And maybe you're a parent listening to this and you can apply this to your mind. Maybe you're not yet a parent, but you should already be starting to think, if you want to be one day, what would I be like? How would I understand the responsibility of authority? How would I measure that out? How would I meet that out with those that God entrusts to me? Solomon's big on team. I would want to say it before I march on. Chapter 1, verse 8, not the only place he says it, but typical, where he says, he talks about your father's instruction and your mother's teaching. Togetherness, team, being together, working together is vital in the concept of parenting. I find that so important. For me and Kate, we have 5 children. You can't afford to be divided. You can't afford to be outside of each other. You need to be together working. And this is why, you know, people with single parents who are raising children of their own need. This is one of the beautiful things about the local church. The church is often the most wonderful context for being able to serve families, children who might not grow up with a male role model or grow up with a mother model, because we haven't got that on our own. We're a single parent. How wonderful if churches can support, can bring input, can provide that in a different kind of way, not actually a dad on the ground, but someone who's able to provide support nevertheless, or simply being a role model to children at the same time. Team is obviously vital in how children are raised, but Solomon's talk, I've talked to, quoting Solomon about the kind of training, discipline side, and there is stuff to do with authority, but most of the work is done through what is taught. Chapter 3, verse 1, my son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. Don't forget my teaching, let your heart not forget my commandments. When we read that on its own, we might make the mistake of interpreting it as basically just behavioral rules. And certainly that's part of it. It's important that parents are able to say, don't do that, do this. There's obviously wisdom on it, comes through commands on their own from time to time. But understand this, this book of Proverbs is written in a context, not in a vacuum. It's written to a community, it's written to Israel, it's written to Jewish children, Jewish young people who have a story. And when we pass on commands to children, or in fact to anybody, I mean, it's kind of what I'm doing here today. I'm, as a preacher of the Bible, passing on commands, passing on counsel from the Bible. This is what you should live like. Here I am doing exactly what's kind of reflected in these verses. But it's done in a context. It's done in the situation where we have a joint story together. Let me help you understand what I mean by going back to Deuteronomy. There's a place in Deuteronomy 6, further back in the Old Testament, that kind of helps us to see how and why commands fit. I'll start reading verse 20. It says, when your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? Which, by the way, they do ask. That's what people ask, isn't it? I mean, if you're a parent, you definitely know what I'm talking about. Kids are always saying that. Why do we have to do that? Why can't we do that? Why can't I stay at her house tonight? Why can't I wear those? Why can't I watch this? Why can't I download that? Why can't I steal this? Why can't I hit him? Why can't I defraud that multinational company? That will come later. But that's, you know, there's a whole load of why that kind of pours out of the heart of a child that's been limited by rules and evil commandments, limitation of conduct. How dare you put a limit on me, a boundary on me? You're squeezing me down. I need to express myself. Why? That's the heart of man, right? Why can't I? Well, the Bible's got answers to that very question. Sometimes it gives quite a straight answer. You know, sometimes parents say, because I said so. That's not altogether wrong, just so we know, okay? Because God sometimes talks like that. Sometimes God says, do this, I am the Lord. You're like, oh, okay, okay. I get what you mean. Okay, so you're allowed, you know, parents are allowed to say, because I said so, just trust me, let's just move along. But that's not the ultimate answer. There's an answer here that God gives through Moses. What is the meaning of the testimonies? In verse 21, then you shall say to your son, listen to this, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and grievous, against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there. And he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. What's my point? My point is that God's commands through the Bible, through preaching, through parents, don't ultimately come in a vacuum. They come within a story. Why can't we do this? With my kids, it's often, he's allowed to, she's allowed to, why can't I? Ultimately, my answer, the answer I must learn to give and teach them to understand as they grow up and train them in, is very simply, you have a different story. You are a different person. You are different. There's something about you. And it's not a bad difference. It's not a shameful difference. It's a glorious one. You have a destiny. You have an identity. You may not understand it yet. You may despise it. You may find it stifling and obstructive and oppressive. But I tell you, if you understood things well, would not trade it for anything. Because who you are, my child in God, is worth any of the fake fulfillments that this passing age can try to sell you. We need parents who raise their children with a different kind of story, different sense of purpose and identity and meaning. My dad used to get home drunk when he was in his teens. Get home drunk, and his dad, who wasn't a Christian, would just laugh. That's just what boys do, right? It's just funny. That's what boys do. They get drunk. It's funny. I got home drunk once, and my dad wept all night. Because he's like this guy here. He's got a vision. He's got a passion. He's got a desire. He's got a story for his children. He says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I want to raise a warrior. I want to raise a world changer. I want to raise a child of God. I have a sense of identity and destiny I'm determined to pass on, in as much as it's up to me. Let me say as a last thing, time's running out, but you've got to hear this. Because there's so much that I've done. For some of you, all I have done in this last 40 minutes is rake up a lot of pain. Like I said earlier, parenting is a context of a lot of reflection and introspection and sorrow in some of our lives where we've got it wrong. Maybe we've got it right and we feel we've got it wrong. I tell you, there's a lot of Christian parents who constantly accuse themselves. I failed. I did it wrong. The reason they're accusing themselves is not because they got it wrong. It's because their children rejected the wisdom. That's in the book of Proverbs as well. There's plenty there for you. You don't have to feel like you are a curse. Children do make their own decisions in the end. They may reject everything that you pass on. Now, we shouldn't give up hope. We should still be prayerful. But we shouldn't live lives of self-accusation. Let me try and set you free from that today, if that's been your portion for the last season of your life. Be free from it. Be free from it anyway. I tell you, this whole realm of parenting is painful because we're constantly aware of how we fail. We sort of see the standard and we fall short of it. If you want proof of that, look at Solomon himself. See, Solomon's got endless wisdom for how to be a good dad or how to be a good child. He had feet of clay. Solomon blew it. He blew it as a dad, in fact, as well as a son. No one's ever completely failed to blow it. There's no child and no parent who's got a perfect record to look at. No one can say, I have been the perfect son. I've been the epitome of what Solomon says when he speaks about this in the Proverbs, where he says in Proverbs chapter 15, verse 20, a wise son makes his father's heart glad. Which one of us can say that about ourselves? Which one of us is the perfect parent? I tell you, if you came to my house and watched me parenting, you'd see some good things, perhaps, for the first few minutes. If you stay around long enough, you'll see some shameful things. You'll see some things I wouldn't want you to see. And too often, that's my story. Too often, I know I blow it, I fail. None of us has done it right. But this is the story the Bible tells. This is the main thing, all right? Get this, this is important. There once was a wise son who made his father's heart glad. There's never been anyone like him. There was one son, one eternal son, the Son of God, Jesus, who never went outside of his father's will, who always did his father's will gladly. He said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me, John chapter 4. He delights to do his will. And he's not a robot, he's not oppressed, he's not limited, he's free, he's liberated, he enjoys life. Why? Because he's perfectly obedient to the Father. He knows how to do life. He's done it perfectly. And here's the amazing thing. He has done it on our behalf. If you think to yourself, I've been a bad child. I've got a broken relationship with my parents for whatever reason. Maybe something has happened to you that's been horrifying and has scarred you. Maybe you've been a bad parent in some way. And I tell you again, that's my story in too many ways. But thankfully, here's my better story. I am now in Christ. Because I'm in Christ. I'm in the perfect son. I'm in the one who makes his father's heart glad. So my story doesn't have to end there. I don't have to be a failure. I've got an opportunity to not only receive God's healing, but to also pray for healing in my relationships. Maybe for some of you, that's exactly what needs to happen.